Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And before we get started this week, I'd just like to say a big thank you to everyone who voted for Risky Business in the European Security Bloggers Awards. We managed to pick up Best Podcast, which is, which is obviously really nice for us. So yeah, thanks everyone. Thanks to everyone who voted for us. On this week's show, in this week's feature, we are chatting with Laurie Love. Laurie is an activist, an online activist, facing extradition to the United States, where prosecutors hope to charge him with a raft of computer-related offences relating to attacks against US government computers. He'll tell us about what's going on with his extradition hearing and why he really, really doesn't want to go to the USA. This week's show is sponsored by Tenable Network Security. Big thanks to them. If you are looking for some vulnerability scanning and management software, you really should talk to Tenable. So in this week's sponsor interview, we are chatting with Chris Cleary. He is a director of business development at Tenable, and his focus is on the US federal government. We'll be chatting to him about the fallout of the OPM breach 1 year on. There have been some significant changes to the way things are handled in the United States since OPM, Chris says, but it is still too soon to see if they are panning out as intended. All that is coming up later, but first, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, as it turns out, Jacob Applebaum, best known for his work with WikiLeaks and the Tor project, is a horrible...
It certainly does appear that way. There's been a bunch of things that have surfaced on the internet over the last week or so, alleging all manner of kind of, you know, sexual misconduct, kind of up to and including rape, from a number of sources, you know, some of which are anonymous, some of which have very much put their names on things. But all up, it's really not looking very good. The Tor project has put out a press release talking about it, and he has resigned from his role, sort of advisory role, advocacy role with the Tor project. And we've seen, a bunch of back and forth over the internet. But yeah, really, it does not look or sound real good. I've never met the guy, but by all accounts, that appears to be a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've never met him either, but look, I've reached out to a lot of people I know who do know him, and the words that have come back are like, quote, egomaniacal sleaze, emotionally abusive, insane. And, you know, these aren't anonymous allegations. They may have started as anonymous allegations, but now we've got very, you know, people who are very much known quantities in the information security industry coming forward to talk about this. In particular, the post that really impressed me from a courage standpoint was Lee Honeywell, who I believe now works at Slack, came forward discussing some very personal stuff involving him that goes back a decade. But, he initially put out a statement saying, I deny, and it was very interesting, the wording, I deny any allegations of criminal sexual misconduct. You know, he was talking about suing people and blah, 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 blah. Since then, his legal counsel has backed away from, talk of injunctions and things like that. But he even said that, you know, over the years, people have tried to discredit my work, which is such a dog whistle, you know, trying to Assange away these allegations, yeah, and say that it's some sort of plot by agencies because, you know, his work is worth discrediting. I mean, what a slimeball, honestly.
Yeah, well, exactly. And certainly, I read Lee Honeywell's post about it, and she's, spoken to KiwiCon. She's very good people, and was a pretty big indictment on things. And yeah, having real names behind it, I guess, does make it harder for people to kind of hand wave and dismiss away. The parallels to Assange, I guess, and certainly, you know, Jake Applebaum's support of Assange and kind of derision of the people who were accusing Assange, you know, that kind of ties in, and you end up seeing, you know, a big picture that really isn't very pretty. And obviously the Tor project is kind of put in a difficult place of, you know, it doesn't change the value of Tor as a project or indeed the work that he has done on it. But it does, you know, people are shitbags across all sort of, you know, all fields of endeavor, and, you know, unfortunately InfoSec is one of them. And I don't, you know, certainly the story you get from people is that this is not really a surprise to anybody.
Even Tor put that out in their statement. Now, you know, at the time I tweeted that they'd thrown him under the bus, which people people took, you know, they interpreted that as me sort of defending Applebaum and saying that they shouldn't have done that. But really, I was just being cautious because I didn't want to be sued for libel. you know, I was just trying to draw attention to the fact that Tor were distancing themselves from him very quickly after the allegations surfaced. But, you know, it snowballed to the point now where I can safely sit here in front of my microphone and say that Jacob Applebaum is, by all accounts, an awful human being.
Yes, well, and that does seem to be the case. I mean, the you know, the stories I have heard are such that, you know, he is, you know, not a safe, you know, that it is generally well known that he is not a safe person to go drinking with, you know, if you're a woman, which is unfortunately a sad and very long list in this community, and the thing that, you know, those of us that organize events like Kiwi Con and that sort of thing, you know, do take quite a lot of care to try and make sure we have environments that are safe, you know, for everyone to be in, regardless of whether you're drinking or what you're, you know, whatever else you're doing, so that you can enjoy yourself and not feel at risk. And clearly he's one of those people that you know, that is a risk to people in the community, which, you know, which is shit. It just sucks.
But it seems, Adam, that like everybody knew about this except you and me. Do you know what I mean? Which begs the question, how the hell did he get away with it? And, you know, look, and that's probably unfair to a lot of people who did know what he was like, because as Nick Farr's Medium post pointed out, this guy is vindictive and a hell of a bully, which would explain why people were quite scared to speak up against him.
Well, yeah, but, you know, the whole kind of, it's, you know, it's complicated, the you know, sort of the interaction between the bystander effect and all of the things that, you know, that people know in small quantities, but when you aggregate together, you know, turn into a bigger picture. And it's very difficult. I mean, I obviously we have experience running a community hackathon for 10 years of dealing with shitbags and people who we know, you know, we don't necessarily want at our events, and we can kind of communicate through back channels with other hackathons to try and do that. But it's very difficult to turn that into something that you can stand behind publicly, especially when, you know, you're operating on a collection of stories from other people and you know, sort of, you know, community scuttlebutt rather than, you know, specific allegations that are backed up in a way that you can act on them. And there's that very big sort of gamut between, you know, someone who's a skis at the pub when they're drinking through to, you know, rape and you know, all sorts of bad things. And it's just, you know, there's a lot of stuff on that continuum that's very hard to pin down when you're trying to create safe spaces and trying to create an environment where it is okay for everyone to have a good time. But
it's the bullying component to this that bothers me as well. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, for you know, we've all known a sleazy guy. Do you know what I mean? And a sleazy guy in isolation is one thing. I mean, he's still a sleazy guy and it's still not a good thing, but women will generally just tell them to piss off. It's another thing when it's someone who is revered and respected, and, you know, it's people in this community who've kind of enabled that offending by offering him that status and respect. And that's one part of this that really bothers me, is that he was using his status and authority to be horribly abusive towards people. And that just, it really gives me the chills.
Yeah, no, that does suck a lot, eh? And I guess there's a long history of people, you know, who have a lot of social capital abusing that, you know, for other purposes. And this is, you know, a classic example of that, unfortunately. And, you know, I don't know that, I mean, I was about to say, I don't know that the InfoSec community is necessarily worse than any other on that front, but I don't know. It's kind of hard to say whether that is the case
I think the InfoSec community does have a sexism problem.
Well, clearly,
I think it's something that doesn't get the attention that it should. But, you know, the fact that this person was misusing their status, authority, and, you know, I mean, it just, look, and I'm glad to see this thing blow up the way it has. Anyway, look, let's move on to some happier news. I don't know, depending on your point of view. The Singaporean government is going to take away internet access from its civil servants' computers. This is a really interesting idea. They're going to introduce instead, they're going to have like internet, like web kiosks in the offices and allow people to still get on the net from BYOD devices. But government computers, no more internet for you. Come back. Never.
It's really hard to say that this isn't a great idea. I mean, you know, as someone who breaks into computers for a living, the fact that they are internet connected is really, really helpful.
Yes. And if this,
you know, even people who, you know, are on corporate environments where internet access is restricted, you know, that doesn't really matter. I mean, we can find a way to tunnel stuff through, because obviously the restrictions are, well, you can go to YouTube. Well, I can stick data in a YouTube video. We're done here. So, yeah, I think, you know, actually just flat out blocking internet access from corporate environments, especially sensitive ones, is a great idea. And I think it's good that Singapore, you know, despite being such a, you know, sort of connected and relatively high-tech place, is willing to go to that extent to do it. That seems like a really good idea. And obviously, splitting off BYOD devices has a separate set of risks, but compared to just having IE6 on your, you know, your government workstation running out of that flash and getting owned, that seems like an improvement. We'll see whether they actually manage to pull it off. There's riots in the streets.
The big question is going to be whether the efficiency hit is worth it. Do you know what I mean? Because there will be an efficiency hit here, but I don't know that it will be as bad as people will fear. I mean, hopefully we're going to find out because they're planning on doing this May next year. So hopefully in about 12 months from now, you know, a month after they've done it, we're going to know. But look, it's a very interesting idea because, you know, they're still allowing email to the workstations, but if the only thing you've got to worry about is connections between workstations and an SMTP or, you know, IMAP box, then, geez, your job just got a lot easier, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that does limit the sort of things that attackers can use to get stuff in and out and gives you one set of content to inspect, which is a lot easier than having to do it for everything. So, yeah, I mean, assuming that people can live without Facebook and, you know, maybe there'll be a productivity increase because people aren't sitting around Facebook and from work or whatever, you know, I guess we will see how well it goes for them. But good luck. Godspeed.
Godspeed, you brave Singaporeans. What the hell, Adam? What the hell is going on with TeamViewer? I first got an email about this about a month ago from a listener. There have been so many boxes running TeamViewer that have been popped, and no one seems to quite know what's happening.
Yeah, it's really not clear. So, I mean, TeamViewer is a remote access solution that gives, you know, an easy way to get, you know, remote access to Windows boxes and that kind of thing. And a whole bunch of people's machines that are using the TeamView service are getting owned. And obviously, the, you know, one option is that TeamViewer themselves got owned, access to the accounts is being then used to gain access to people's machines. Or TeamViewer's answer is that it's actually credential reuse from a number of the other big breaches that have happened lately, and attackers have only just kind of discovered that TeamViewer is a thing.
And they've probably automated the process somewhat, and that could explain it. I mean, that seems like a fairly, you know, sensible explanation for this.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It seems like quite a reasonable one. I mean, the suggestion is that, yeah, password reuse, you log into the TeamViewer, like web-based interface, you get a list of machines that are associated with the account you just got into, and you can then, without much other auth, go onwards to control those machines. And that would certainly be a believable thing. I don't know how big TeamViewer is and what kind of percentages. And that's one of the challenges here is that no one seems to know quite how big the problem is. It's just getting a lot of traction on Reddit and, you know, other places where people are whinging about TeamViewer. TeamViewer themselves seem kind of frustrated. I mean, there's an interview that Ars is running with a spokesperson from TeamViewer where they're kind of saying, well, no one's sending us any logs, you know, from the client, so we don't really know what's going on, and it's very, very difficult, and we've got two-factor. Surely people should turn the two-factor on and kind of hand-wave. So, yeah, we don't really know. Other than that, a whole bunch of people are getting owned, which, you know, I guess is situation normal on the internet these days.
Speaking of awful passwords.
So Mark Zuckerberg got his Twitter and his Pinterest owned used because he had credential reuse from his LinkedIn. I don't know why Mark Zuckerberg needs a LinkedIn account or a Twitter account for that reason. Like, I gather he doesn't really use his Twitter account. Anyway, his password was da da da. So like six characters, two letters. Not a lot of entropy in that. But anyway, password reused that across his Pinterest and his Twitter. They got owned. Some hackers had some fun, you know, posting with those. And it's all very silly.
It is. Very quickly, a Canadian university, the University of Calgary, paid $16,000 to recover data in a CryptoLocker thing, CryptoLocker infection. So, you know, this is very much a live issue that is still affecting people. These guys are collecting millions and millions of dollars and no doubt pouring it back into R&D. So I think this is going to be a challenge for at least the next 3 to 5 years for sure. Another big story, the so-called Russian Facebook got popped. It's called VK. Is that right? And 100 million credentials got dumped. I mean, that's a lot of creds.
That is a lot of creds, although you've got to wonder how many of those are real accounts and how many are just, you know, like Putin sock puppets or something. but yeah, 100 million accounts popped of the 300 million that apparently are actually registered. Someone's selling it for like one Bitcoin on some forum somewhere. which, you know, does seem rather low compared to the, you know, very hyped up amounts of money that you read in vendor briefing documents. But yes, if you want 100 million creds and you have one Bitcoin and a Russian forum account, then you too can go and buy the data and see if it's legit and whether or not it actually is just a, you know, the LinkedIn breach repackaged yet again.
Moving over to Vice's motherboard blog, and apparently Drydex and Lockie have both just disappeared.
Yeah, so it looks like the one of the botnets that was being used to deliver the Drydex banking malware and the Lockie, you know, crypto locker style malware has just disappeared. Someone is sinkholing it or blew it away, or it blew up, or someone stole it, or, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, the command and control is gone. Some people, I gather, are sinkholing it, and we don't really know who or what. There was some suggestion that there was a big raid in Russia on a hacker crew that had been doing banking fraud inside Russia, which seems like a pretty poor idea if you're a Russian, because, I mean, you know, there's the whole rest of the world and they're not going to arrest you for that. So, you know, good advice there. But yeah, so no one's really quite sure whether that's associated or not. You know, we will see whether it shows up again. I mean, you know, there may be someone who puts their hand up and says, yes, we did a big botnet takedown, and there'll be some arrests to come. But yeah, for now, it does seem like the volume of malware you're getting in your mailbox may go down for a little while.
Joseph Cox, also at Motherboard, has written a interesting story here about, and he's been digging into this over the last couple of weeks, about how the GCHQ in the United Kingdom is, you know, handing over metadata, you know, presumably obtained from undersea cable taps, pretty much willy-nilly to lower law enforcement agencies. This is pretty concerning.
Yeah, it is. And this is the, you know, the sort of the kind of thing that we, I guess, expected to see in the Snowden docs. And then it's taken a real while for there to be, you know, strong evidence or anything that really suggests, you know, large scale cooperation between state intelligence and the police. And we saw bits of it with the, you know, the Drug Enforcement Agency in the US and the FBI and some stuff about the power construction cases we've seen elsewhere. But in this case, there's some Snowden documents about this program called Milkwhite, where, you know, various elements of the law enforcement community in the UK are getting large-scale access to metadata intercepted from, you know, from cable intercepts in the UK, and then just, you know, using it willy-nilly without really much oversight. And that's kind of interacts poorly with some of the legislation that's in process in the UK at the moment.
Yo, GCHQ, you mind if we borrow your submarine? You know, yeah, like it's a like, bit, oh, yeah, I don't know about this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, wielding the apparatus of state intelligence for domestic law enforcement just seems, I mean, there's a reason we don't use the military for state law enforcement, right?
I mean,
it's just a thing that goes badly and you end up living in a fascist dystopia. And
yeah,
clearly the UK is a fascist dystopia now. So,
yay, plastic man David Cameron. Awesome. now, look, again, another Joseph Cox story. I really like Joseph's stories for Vice Motherboard. I think he's an excellent writer. He's freelance, but, you know, he mostly contributes over there and he's doing an excellent job. He's written an interesting story here about how easy it is to run malicious Facebook ads. And the reason, you know, I mean, that seems kind of elementary, but the reason that I point it out is because I'm wondering how long it's going to be before Facebook is going to start facing the same challenges as media is, you know, general media with all of this adware crap. Because 9 times out of 10, when you look at a Facebook ad, it is for something very sketchy. And, you know, it looks like we're moving from sketchy ads for like work from home and make $10,000 an hour sort of ads to like legit malware. And, you know, this is something they're going to have to get on top of. And, you know, if Facebook gets on top of this sort of problem, it's going to be good for everyone because they have a habit of sharing their knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, the, you know, the ad networks in general have been a really active vector in distributing malware and all sorts of other nasty targeted attack things. And yeah, the other ad networks have to deal with it. Clearly, Facebook is in the same boat. And yeah, hopefully, they'll be able to share some of the techniques they use because, yeah, it is a very difficult problem to solve, you know, both in terms of making the, you know, the content safe and then also stopping it from being abused in all sorts of other ways, like over-targeting the ads or changing the contents after it's been shipped or, you know, there's all sorts of oversight stuff that's very, very difficult to do well. Joseph Cox's piece is actually based on some work done by Justin Seitz, who's an ex-colleague of mine when we worked in Immunity together, who's a very, very smart cat talking through the way that he could very quickly generate fake ads or ads that were sort of misleading on Facebook. And, you know, he's a pretty smart guy, but it is very, very strange for it to do. So hopefully they can come up with something to make it, you know, even marginally more complicated would be good.
Yeah, it just makes me remember a story a few few years ago where this guy started pranking his roommate by creating you remember this? When he created like a Facebook ad that was like really freakily specific to this one guy, and he like targeted it at him as like an individual, as the group for the you know, advertising targeting. That's a funny one. Google around for that if you don't remember that from a few years ago.
Story.
There's some more like very Stuxnet-like ICS malware that's popped up, and FireEye has taken a look at it.
Yeah, there's a piece of malware, they're calling it Iron Gate, and it appears to use a lot of very similar techniques to Stuxnet and has targeting for industrial control systems, although it appears to only be targeting like an industrial control system simulator, not the actual live hardware, but it does the same sort of, you know, patch the thing that uploads the ladder logic to the PLCs and then capture the regular operation and replay it so that it, you know, like the bank heist trick of replaying the security camera footage while you're breaking into the vault, like does that kind of thing with the telemetry data from the control systems. And yeah, so it's very, very Stuxnet-esque. No one's really sure what it's for or who wrote it, and it doesn't look, I mean, according to the work that FireEye have been doing, they're saying it doesn't look nation statey because of some aspects of it, but you know, I guess it's a good example of the kind of trickle down of nation state style activity into clearly other groups, wherever the hell they are, even if it's just researchers you know, working this stuff up in a lab and somehow it's got out. I don't know, it's very strange.
It might be and this is a word that does not get used nearly often enough in this industry, it might be a lark.
that is a thing that we do occasionally do in this industry is for the lulz.
Now, mate, I love this story. I just love this story. In its infinite wisdom, because they're such a smart group of people with really sane views of the world and really sensible ideas, the Islamic State some time ago released an app called Haroof. They released it via its Telegram channel. Now, what could possibly go wrong when an organization like ISIS actually starts releasing and promoting apps? What could go wrong?
Gee, I wonder. So surprising absolutely no one, there are malware-laden fake versions of ISIS Android apps knocking around on the internet and getting people owned, and now the ISIS people are getting all worried about whether it's safe to install their ISIS apps to, you know, do the terrorism from the phone or whatever it is that they do on them. Yes, no one, anyone, anywhere is surprised, although it's an Android app as well. So I'm not sure even if the app was, you know, robust and well-designed and not filled with malware and distributed through an appropriately PKI signed channel, they'd still have a world of problems because Android. But yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, they released it over Telegram, and of course, like, fake ones are going to pop up in the Android store and stuff, like cloned, whatever. Like, it's just these guys, I mean, it just shows you that whoever released that in the first place, like, they don't understand. And, you know, with NSA and from what I understand, other elements of the US, you know, military apparatus really ramping stuff up against those guys. All I can say is, haha, I hope you get drone struck. Very quickly, let's not even talk about it, but a WordPress plugin with 10,000 installs is being exploited in the wild to the surprise of absolutely no one. There's apparently some...
My shocked face.
The Angular exploit kit apparently now contains some... exploits that bypass EMET, which is kind of interesting, or EMET, I'm sorry. You know, the Microsoft brand Nazis will get onto me if I mispronounce that one.
You call it EMET.
Yes, yes. No, it's EMET. So yes, EMET bypass. This is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I mean, the techniques they're using are, you know, sort of derivatives of kind of ROP style stuff. But no, it's really, it is interesting to see the state of the art being pushed as always. And if you're in the exploit dev industry, then yeah, these techniques are worth reading about. There's some good write-ups available. But yeah, you know, arms race continues, and I'm sure they'll go and figure out some ways to make the import prediction and stuff work better on Emmet again, and off we will continue.
Some NTP patches have been pushed that should make NTP amplification attacks, DDoS attacks, a little bit more difficult to accomplish, which will be great news in 20 years when most NTP devices are actually running this latest version.
Right. Now, they patched like half a dozen different DOS conditions and things that you could use for traffic amping in the upstream NTP code base. Of course, yeah, as you say, there are a lot of devices that are running NTP that are embedded and never going to get patches, certainly not in reasonable time, which is ironic being a time server. And yeah, things will continue as they always have, which is bad.
20 years from now, they'll just have to move on to SNMP amplification attacks. There you go. The latest Android security bulletin contains a bunch of updates for critical Qualcomm flaws. We're seeing a fair bit of this lately.
Yeah, so they patched like, it must be what, like half a dozen, seven or eight local privesks in various Qualcomm drivers. They're all awful, as you would expect, from third-party code that interacts with hardware and runs in the kernel space. They also did the traditional monthly patch of yet more bugs in the media server stage fright component because, you know, Lord knows that thing could do with at least a monthly patch, you know, probably needs a patch every day. But yeah, lots of those. It doesn't matter because no one's going to get any of these patches, so that's fine.
Now, in response to the Duo Labs research that we spoke about last week about the bloatware on laptops, you know, the awful, awful software that you should absolutely nuke off your device when you buy it, that stuff, Lenovo has apparently recommended that users delete its own software from their boxes, which is, you know, I got to say, like, it's good that they didn't dig in and turn this into some sort of PR war. They've actually said, yeah, look, fair cop, this software is rubbish. Please do nuke it.
Yes, you know, it is nice. Apparently Lenovo's response to Duo's research has actually been pretty good. I mean, other than telling people to uninstall their application. But yeah, so it is good to see. Whether or not they will actually also then get rid of it from the stock builds in reasonable time is another thing. Obviously there's a lot of machines in the supply chain that are already pre-imaged that are gonna have this stuff forever. So it'd be nice to see them doing something proactive about those as well. But yeah. No, vendors are getting a wake-up call, hopefully, about the quality of their crapware.
Well, and look, the 2% of their user base who actually hears about this will, I'm sure, uninstall that software, their yeah, fantastic exactly accelerator right app. But look, it bodes well for the future that they're actually taking it seriously to the point where they're prepared to take an image hit. And that's, you know, that's a good thing. Well done, Lenovo. You get a biscuit. Uber has paid $10,000 for a login bypass exploit, which is kind of cool. I guess, you know, that's a bug bounty thing, but I guess, you know, we have seen stories of people misusing, you know, stolen Uber creds to take awesome Uber black rides around, you know, the circumference of Manhattan and things like that. So I guess $10,000 isn't too much to pay for a bug that people would absolutely love to use.
Yeah, no, that does seem like a very reasonable price for what was quite a sweet bug. I mean, obviously not technically super sophisticated, but very effective. Which is, of course, what you're looking for as a hacker. And yeah, good value for money there to the Finnish guy who found that.
Checkpoint, meanwhile, reported a bug to Facebook that's a pretty interesting one. It enabled you to retrospectively change Facebook Messenger conversations, which was kind of, you know, I mean, you can think of some pretty gnarly uses for that, but it wasn't particularly easy to exploit. It was a bit of an edge case, but still, you know, we're talking about a bug in Facebook's core functionality, which, you know, that's still a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these bugs that's just kind of, you know, it's kind of dumb from a hacking perspective. Like, it's not remote code exec and it's not, you know, a glamorous bug, but it's one of those ones that if you figured it out, you could do some pretty nefarious kind of sneaky things with it. But being able to retroactively rewrite message history, although I believe this only affected the Android app, not the desktop actual web interface or something. But yeah, being able to overwrite people's message history was, I think it would be more use for, you know, people who are trying to mess with other people's heads rather than necessarily hacking. But you could be very sneaky with this, both for good or for evil.
Well, apparently the bug affected, the bug affected the Android Messenger interface, but the message content was still correctly reflected on other platforms, right? So
yes, yeah, but the different clients would display messages with the same ID differently. Rather, you know, one would sort by most recent, one would sort by least recent, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it just very strange, curious little bug. And yeah, I don't know what you'd do with it, but it wouldn't be good, I'm sure.
Exactly, but they fixed it and we can all move on. Adam, that is it for the week's news. Thanks so much for joining us, and I will chat to you again in 3 weeks.
Oh yeah, you're taking a few weeks off to go have some relaxation, and I'll talk to you when you're back.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. I am taking 2 weeks leave from this week. So yeah, there will be no show next week or the week after. So yeah, do make sure there are no gaps in your incident responders roster. When I go on holidays, bad shit tends to happen. So you have been warned. But yeah, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Laurie Love. Laurie is an online activist who US prosecutors allege broke into a bunch of US government systems. These intrusions peeved the USA so much that they are seeking to extradite Laurie to the US of A to face trial. Now, of course, if I break into a US government system from Australia or Brazil or anywhere, I have committed a crime in both jurisdictions, and that seems quite logical. So normally you'd think, well, you know, what's the problem with the USA seeking extradition in these types of circumstances? Well, the problem is sentencing. If Laurie were charged in the UK with similar offences or even these offences, he'd probably spend a short time in prison and then be released. But in the USA, charges under the CFAA are, as we know, very, very serious. Now, I don't know how seriously to take Laurie's claims in this interview, but he says the USA can load him up with a possible sentence of 99 years if he doesn't take a deal. And of course, they're not offering him a deal at the moment because, well, he's still in Britain. Now, even if Laurie's claim of 99 years, even if that claim is exaggerated, there is no doubt that US computer crime sentences are massively out of step with other comparable jurisdictions, which presents an interesting dilemma for authorities in the UK. Should they hand over one of their citizens to face a sentencing regime that would be considered insane by the English judiciary? Laurie Love joined me via Skype to talk about his situation.
Well, it's quite a long story, but I'm facing extradition to the USA by no less than three different districts that would very much like my presence. This is 2.5 years after I was arrested by the UK's National Crime Agency under our Computer Misuse Act. And unfortunately, they never got around to charging me. And I was kept on bail for 9 months and then released from bail. Started very politely asking for my property back, which is a whole other story. But then last July, a couple of people turned up at the door and arrested me under extradition request. So we're in the process of fighting those, for which I've got some hearings coming up at the end of, one hearing coming up at the end of this month. And we're largely on balance in favour of me not being extradited.
Yeah, now I'd imagine you wouldn't want to be extradited to the United States because they tend to be quite harsh in their sentencing compared to other jurisdictions like, well, in particular Australia and the UK, when you look at sentences of people like Jake Davis and Ryan Cleary and the like, who got off relatively light for the mayhem they caused, whereas they would have been put in a very deep hole in the United States for a long time. But look, let's just go into what it is that they've actually, what it is they're actually trying to extradite you for. What is it that they are alleging you have done?
So somewhere around 2013, some US government agency computers networks were compromised. I was asked some questions in relation to those, to which I wasn't able to provide much information. But it's a kind of litany of different agencies, which I can't really remember all of them, but it includes NASA and the Federal Reserve Bank and the FBI and some Department of Defense things. I don't know, something about missile defense.
And what actually happened to these systems in these incidents that they're seeking to question you over? What did the attackers do? I mean, was this some sort of political activism? What was the reason these things were breached?
Sure. So the wider context is quite a tragic story, really. But a young gentleman called Aaron Swartz, who committed suicide after he was prosecuted by the Department of Justice in what some consider to be quite a political and overzealous prosecution after he downloaded too many articles from the online article archive JS store using the bandwidth of the MIT campus. And it's widely believed that this is because he had been involved in some political work opposing some poorly fought through legislation, CISPA and SOPA, which were ultimately defeated by a wide campaign, including ultimately Google and WikiLeaks and other big names on the internet who kind of said this is our line in the sand when it comes to interfering too much with online rights and privacy in the interest of protecting business.
Yeah, we all followed the Aaron Swartz thing, and it was, a real tragedy. So these incidents were, I'm guessing, in a response to that. But, I mean, there's a bit of an irony there, isn't there, that, these were protesting, these incidents may have happened by someone protesting the CFAA charges against Aaron Swartz, and this is the act under which they're trying to extradite you.
Yeah, so from my understanding, based on the public information about the campaign, the aims were to motivate some reform to the CFAA as an act in itself, to the sentences that are imposed and the definitions of unauthorized access, definitions of damages, and mandatory sentencing practices and the wider system of plea bargaining, all of which contributed, in the view of some anyway, to putting Aaron in an impossible position where he was forced to make a choice that he couldn't, because of his principles, accept, which was to plead guilty to something which he didn't believe was a crime to avoid a much harsher punishment. So to find myself in a potentially a similar situation does come with some irony, which isn't lost on me. But what I'm hoping is it will also not be lost on the court, and in coming to their decision about whether to accept or refuse the extradition request, they might consider the issues that we've raised about the US justice system, including these sentencing practices.
I believe in some instances, like Jeremy Hammond was alleged to have obtained credit card information, things like that. Are there any allegations that you have done something similar, or is it, because I know there is an allegation that you had obtained the details, the personal information of 100,000 Department of Energy staff in the United States. That is one of the charges. But are there any charges relating to financial fraud, or is it all, you know, information-based offences? You downloaded, you know, are alleged to have downloaded user information and, you know, perhaps what is there, defacements in there as well, I'm presuming?
So, again, this is just on my memory of the public indictments, but there are charges of identity fraud, I think aggravated identity fraud, but what that comes down to is having access to identity instruments, which is personally identifying information such as would be exposed in a database breach. And there are reports from, for example, the Department of Energy, where the Inspectorate General decided to have a bit of an investigation into what happened there and determined, from what I remember, that a lot of records were exposed to the internet that needn't have been. And so the Department of Energy would have had to spend some money kind of giving people assurances that their identity was protected. And the legal theory is that this is a cost that was caused by the compromise.
Look, they love to load up costs, right? Because they need to make it stick under the CFAA. But what's the maximum sentence you could face, or the likely sentence you could face if you are extradited to the United States and these charges are proven?
So, again, there's this very interesting sentencing arithmetic, which is very convoluted, and I've heard. Done my best to read through the testimony that our legal experts in the US have compiled. And because there are three jurisdictions and I could potentially face three prosecutions if I didn't decide to plead guilty and take a deal, and various aggravating factors and the charges that are levied, they put them together and the figure was 99 years, which...
That's a rather long time, Laurie.
It's a long time. I mean, in a way, it would be nice if I could expect to see another 99 years.
Glass half full. At least you'd have some certainty. At least you'd have some certainty in your life as well. You know.
Yeah, sure. it gets to the point where it's academic, and for me, just the prospect of entering the US justice system is worse than. Being sentenced for the most serious crimes in the UK, even a murder sentence, I would expect to be eligible for release after 20 years under ordinary circumstances. And in the US, I just don't imagine any kind of future.
Have you instructed your solicitors to ask prosecutors in the United States what sort of deal they would be looking for? Do you know what that would look like?
Yeah, so very interestingly, for the only people, as far as I can determine, that want to put me in a small box for the rest of my life, then quite reticent to talk about it. So I probably ill-advisedly kind of called up one of the US attorneys just to sort of see what was going on and could maybe suggest that he unrequest my extradition so I could go to CCC camp in Berlin and then maybe re-request it afterwards. It was just very inconvenient for me because I'd been planning to go to this camp for quite a while. So I just wanted to see what the crack was, and I called him up and he didn't want to talk to me. He said that it would be unprofessional of him to talk to me without my attorney present. And I suggested that I don't really have a US attorney because I've never been to the USA and I don't really expect to have to worry too much about laws that I couldn't have broken by not having been there. And he didn't want to talk about this any further and got a bit nervous and kind of hung up the phone on me. And so since then, I have asked an attorney at law in the USA to suggest a few things that might be nice, such as discovery, which is the usual thing where people who are charged with crimes get to see the evidence.
Now this is the really interesting part, isn't it? This is where it gets really Kafka-esque, is because you don't know what sort of evidence these prosecutors plan to introduce against you. You've got no idea. They're just making an extradition request and they're saying, we have evidence, turn him over and the evidence will be presented in court. But you can't actually fight the prima facie idea behind the prosecution until you get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I first found out that I'd been charged with crimes by hearing it on the BBC Radio 4 national radio station. And I was about to get on the phone and correct them because I didn't remember being charged on the way out of the police station earlier in the day. And then I haven't been charged in the UK since then. I'm still not interesting enough to the law to be prosecuted. But for 2.5 years, I faced a whole series of allegations and indictments that I have no recourse to contest, and I'm not able to see what the evidence behind them is. And worst of all, and people find this very hard to understand, the US doesn't have to present any evidence to have me extradited. Our extradition treaty doesn't require from them to build a prima facie case. If we wanted to extradite someone from the USA, we would have to reach that evidential bar, but they just have to have their paperwork in order, essentially. And that's quite concerning because this decision effectively dictates the rest of my life. And it'd be nice to have some evidence and, maybe a jury and, to be able to argue the points and stuff.
Well, at least a hearing, right? At least some sort of committal hearing. Now, if you were to face the same charges for the same alleged offences in the United Kingdom, what sort of sentence would you likely be looking at?
So, I mean, the closest comparison I can make is the cases of the LulzSec participants, and I'm good friends with Jake and Mustafa, and they're all getting on with their lives because.
Can you please try to convince Jake to come onto the show? I've even written to him via Twitter. I'm trying to offer him paid work to do InfoSec poetry because he's very funny and he's an excellent writer. So please, I would urge you, do get in touch with your buddy Double Jake. Because he's a very, very funny man. I would very much like his contribution to Risky Business. Sorry for the digression. I didn't know you were friends, but continue, please.
No, we actually went bouldering together last week in London because he's gone very into climbing rocks. And so I went and gave that a go and met a journalist to be interviewed and tried to do it hanging off a rock just for fun. But Jake, I'll speak to him about that and suggest that to him. He's very interested in media things. He's starting a new job. Vaguely in that area,
and good, because I hope he goes into entertainment or media because that's his thing. But I mean, in his case, he did actually serve a small custodial sentence. I know because I read his sort of blogs about it and stuff. Hence why I say he's an excellent writer and very funny. But he did. I mean, he served a matter of months, didn't he?
Yeah. So I mean, the longest sentence was actually for Kayla, and he did. I think it was a sort of 30-month sentence, of which he did maybe 18. So nobody was in custody, as far as I know, for longer than a year and a half. That they have serious crime prevention orders, which are hilarious in their own rights because they have to tell the government every time they use a virtual machine or encryption or something like that, or every time they get a new phone. But they have been largely able to get on with their lives. Mustafa is starting a PhD funded by the Alan Turing Institute researching cryptocurrencies. Jake has a highly successful career ahead of him in media with his fantastic sense of humour. Other LulzSec people are in academia or in gainful employment now because the rest of their lives are not committed to serving as an example, which appears to be how the US decides to rehabilitate people that are convicted of computer crimes.
Now, it seems to me that, US sentencing for computer crime, and I'm not radical in saying this, it's massively out of step with the rest of the world. I mean, it's got to the point, I can think of a couple of cases in Australia. One was the head of Drink or Die, which was a piracy ring. This guy was like breaking, cracking the registration protections on like Adobe software and whatever, and a few other software packages. He'd never left Australia. He was extradited to the United States and did spend some years in a US prison. But I mean, that's it. When it comes down to it, I mean, why is it that governments are extraditing people outside of their jurisdiction to face a sentencing regime that would never be implemented in their own jurisdiction? Like the UK would never threaten sentences like what you will face in the United States. So why do you think they do it?
it's an interesting question, because to most people it seems quite absurd and grossly unfair. You can understand it from the point of view of it being quite difficult to catch a lot of people that are responsible for computer crimes. So there's the idea of putting more emphasis on the deterrent aspect of sentencing to...
I understand. I understand why the US thinks it's doing the right thing by imposing these ridiculous sentences. What I'm wondering is why the UK still feels comfortable extraditing people to the United States to face trial in these jurisdictions, which are not comparable to the UK laws. So why do they do it? Why do they allow it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're about to find out if we do allow it or not. And this is an excellent test case because it's so similar in many regards to Gary McKinnon. I was going to
bring that up, because at the 11th hour they blinked, didn't they, with Gary McKinnon, and they said, no, we're not going to extradite him because he'll top himself. And, you know, we don't want that.
It was one of the rare examples of the power of public pressure causing them to find a way, because Gary had actually expended all of his legal avenues, and the government had to do a little bit of legal chicanery to find a way for the Home Secretary to deny it, which was the right thing. And afterwards they changed the law and introduced this thing called the forum bar, which says if it's in the interest of justice for the prosecution to proceed domestically, there should be no extradition. So whenever people write to their MPs, which I encourage people to do in the UK, and express some concern about why is our country willing to give up its citizens to face these crazy sentences, the token response is, well, we changed the law after the case of Gary McKinnon. We introduced this extra protection, and that means that everything's going to be okay. And the problem is it's not been used successfully, and so we're hoping that this is a case that has enough parallels and puts things into such a stark relief that it gives the court the opportunity to say, well, yeah, some things are a bit too much.
Have the politicians you've been in contact with been sympathetic to your cause?
Yeah, they are, but in a politician-y way. So there are some that are genuinely quite concerned, and they're pushing it a bit further. I don't know how those processes work. I'm sure they're very complicated and bureaucratic. But there's also a Finnish human rights lawyer. So I have dual nationality. My mum's from Finland. I went to Finland and did national service twice. And so had I been arrested in Finland, there would be no question of extradition. And the Finnish government simply wouldn't allow that. And any Finnish citizen has the right to refuse to be extradited under similar circumstances. So we might have to ask the Finnish government if they'd like to take a view on this, because I'm a citizen, and maybe they'd like me to not face these kind of injustices. Mm.
Now, your hearing is scheduled, or the decision is scheduled to come down around June 28 or 29, as you mentioned earlier. What's your feeling on how it's like? Which way do you think it's going to go? I'd imagine that this would be, if I were you, it would be a very stressful situation, and I would be, you know, I'd want to be optimistic, but I'd just be so mortified that I wouldn't really be able to have a reliable opinion on which way I thought it would go. But do you have a gut feel?
It's not going to be probably the decision, but the hearing itself is the 2 days of the 28th and 29th, and we expect a decision might take up to a month afterwards, or possibly longer.
Okay.
I am not an expert in the extradition law. I have thought about it because it's hard not to sometimes, and it keeps me up at night. I think there are a lot of reasons for the extradition to be refused. A lot of people have expressed concern, and a very strong case has been made by some leading legal experts that we have on our team, and I have a feeling that the extradition will be refused, but that may not be the end of the story, that the US can appeal. Appeals can stretch on possibly for months and years.
What if it goes the other way? Can you appeal?
And we can appeal. The one issue is that they recently changed the law so that you don't have an automatic right to an appeal.
You need to seek leave to appeal, I'm guessing.
You seek leave to appeal, and it has to be of interest to the higher court. And interestingly, this legal change happened the month before the extradition request came through. In any case, we would have to file for an appeal. And I do think, because there are a lot of legal questions that come up, such as due process, differences in again the sentencing, access to evidence against you, and the concerns that have been raised about the unbalanced nature of the extradition relations themselves, that it might go to an appeal. I would like some closure. I have other things in my life. I've returned to education. I'm studying to be an electrical engineer. I'm working in InfoSec, funnily enough, making things secure, which is something that we all kind of need to get on with rather than putting our priorities in conflicts that are maybe elective.
Well, Laurie Love, thank you very much for joining us. To sort of recap your situation, it's one that I've been observing over the last few years. But, you know, for one, I certainly hope that if you are to be charged, it is in your own country. Thanks a lot for your time.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Patrick. Thanks a lot.
That was the ever-pleasant Laurie Love there. As you no doubt guessed, I personally really hope he manages to stay in England, even if on the balance of probabilities, you know, going by my gut, I'd say he was indeed a very naughty boy. It's worth reiterating something that Laurie said in that interview too. The people who were caught and served time in the UK over the LulzSec breaches are getting on with their lives and becoming productive members of society. The Americans who faced similar charges over there, well, let's see. Barrett Brown is in prison. He is still writing, though, and do go read his stuff if you get a chance. It's quite good. Jeremy Hammond, also in prison, serving a 10-year sentence. Hector Monsiga, he snitched so hard he actually did manage to save his ass. But honestly, when you look at the sentence he could have faced himself if he didn't sell out his internet friends, well, his choice looks a little bit less skeezy once you take in the broader context. What I'm getting at here is the CFAA strikes me as being a slightly nutty law. I do get it that criminals need to be punished. I get it as well that Hammond was a recidivist and deserved to spend some time in prison. But I just wonder if these federal charges are really pushing American society forward. You know, it's food for thought. But anyway, enough on that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Chris Cleary. Chris is a business development manager with Tenable these days, but his background is as a CNO in the military. So Tenable has him working a lot with defense and federal government in the USA, which makes a lot of sense. So Chris has had a front row seat to a lot of the changes that have taken place in US government circles since the OPM disaster. He joined me via Skype to chat about how the US government is trying to shift responsibility for InfoSec from the IT guys to the senior bureaucrats. And as you'll hear, it's too early to say if these initiatives are working, but it certainly seems like a step in the right direction. Chris Cleary.
Right now, a lot of these organizations are broken up. You got the guys that sit in the dark rooms that are responsible for your information technology systems, and the subset of that is typically where your security guys live. On the other side of the fence, you have the operators, right? You have whoever the guys are that do the business of whatever organization or agency you have. As requirements come down for the guys on the IT side to comply with certain programs, we use the non-DOD guys, let's use the federal side under the CDM program. Hey, you shall go do X. And one of the things you need to do is protect your systems, and you need to be, you know, checking for certain vulnerabilities. Here's a bunch of tools you can use to go do that. The problem is the guys in the IT side of the house that do that don't always necessarily understand what's happening in the operational side. Or they'll say to their boss, hey, you know, we've instituted this new program, and, you know, 85% of the vulnerabilities that we're aware of are being fixed. Well, it's the 15 that are not being fixed that, even though they're aware of, are the ones that allows things like OPM to happen.
So how has the government actually moved to address that?
So the way the government's trying to respond to this is bring both the information technology side of the house and the operational side of the house closer together, and to say, you as the director of a certain organization are going to be held to account just as responsible for something that you always believed was an IT function. We're now going to hold you accountable for this, because the security and operation of your networks is just as important as the delivery of the services that you do as an agency.
So basically, they're saying the security of the network is no longer the responsibility of the IT department down there somewhere. This is a board, you know, board equivalent of a board level issue, department level issue, if you will. You know, you need to take care of this. And that's been in response to OPM, has it?
Yeah, and that is every bit as important as what your day-to-day mission is. Mm. And it should be considered part of your day-to-day mission. Operating and defending and securing your networks is now every bit as important as delivering whatever the product or service is that you do as a federal government.
Is this approach actually working? Are you actually seeing evidence of change at the coalface?
So that's, you know, the government is not a fast-moving organization. There's still a lot of culture clashes within these organizations. You know, the the operators never like the IT wonks, and the IT wonks don't think that the operators get what it is they do day to day, and you know, they don't understand technology. So there's still that clash of civilizations between, you know, the operators and the technologists, and them trying to get within sync with each other. And I think we're still many years from that being effective. Now, the Department of Defense, which is an organization that can move a lot faster because we all live under a certain hierarchy, a chain of command. You know, the boss says go do, and you know, the boss says jump, and you say hi, hi. It moves considerably faster than the Department of Defense, and they understand the importance of mission assurance with the systems that support combat operations. So I'll say in the DoD, it's moving a lot faster. It's still not a perfect system, but the hierarchy, the chain of command, the responsibility, the accountability, putting on commanding officers to make sure that their systems are protected. I'll say that's considerably further down the road and a little bit ahead of where maybe some of these state, local government, other federal civilian agencies are.
Yeah, I mean, I get that there's always going to be that culture clash between the IT team and the normals, shall we say. But what about the senior bureaucrats? Do you think they get it now?
Well, I think they get it through the perspective of the light is definitely being shined on them. You see a lot of hearings on the Hill. A lot of people ask to come to testify as to, you know, why this didn't happen, or, you know, you knew about these vulnerabilities, why weren't they fixed? Of course, then it goes back to, well, you know, you can't do this overnight. And then, hey, we see vulnerabilities associated with legacy systems. And if I make this patch, it's going to break this legacy system, which I need to operate, which means I need X amount of more dollars to replace this legacy system. And that's going to happen in 18 to 24 months. And if we could start over from square one and just get rid of everything and start from scratch, that would be one way to approach this, but, you know, not practical and ridiculously expensive.
Let's detonate all U.S. government systems and start again. Yeah, I think that might be the ultimate optimist's way of thinking there, Chris.
It would be great for the commercial industry. We'd love that, right? I mean, because it would just be a feeding frenzy of opportunity.
Well, but it already is. I mean, it's not like InfoSec is struggling at the moment, you know?
Oh, no, not at all. You're absolutely right.
Now, look, one of the consistent bits of feedback I get across, the commercial sector is that the lack of staff, the lack of capable staff, well-trained people at affordable wages is the defining issue of InfoSec. I believe Alex Stamos from Facebook, CSO of Facebook, even tweeted about that the other day, just saying this is going to be the issue for the next decade. Is that something that's being felt in government as well? I imagine it is, and not only do I imagine it is, but I imagine that it's probably even worse in government because there's pay constraints that don't exist in the commercial sector.
Oh, yeah. You see a lot of guys, the government is losing a lot of their best people to internet startups, the Tenables of the world, you know, Silicon Valley, all these guys. This is a very limited skill set. And I'll tell you the other thing, not to go back to get, you know, tactical to practical for an example, but I have a lot of my friends that are Navy SEALs. And right now, Navy SEALs can seem to go do anything, right? Because everybody loves Navy SEALs. But also in the commercial world, everybody loves somebody that has cybercom on the back of their name or had some sort of experience within an operational environment because they're being seen as the true, you know, cyber experts. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, not to put, you know, use a military analogy, but it is the majority of my life. You know, you and I could go to an Army Navy store and get camouflage and, you know, a pack and a rifle, but that doesn't make you a soldier, right? You could have all the equipment and basically know how to use that equipment. But you don't know how to employ it as it was designed. And I gave a talk at DEF CON a couple of years ago, and I used the example of a deer hunter and a military sniper. And you know, at the end of the day, they both know how to use their tool, and they could both hit a target at a known range. But the military guy is trained to do so many other things, you know, talk on the radio, jump out of an airplane, knows how to do first aid, knows how to just live in the woods for days.
You know, this is why Google pretty consistently guts the SIGINT agencies of their best people, right? So, I mean, I understand that that's an issue that applies to SIGINT, but does that extend to the civilian arms of government as well?
Both of them. Yeah, I would say if you've got a particular skill set, a lot of those, it's funny, a lot of those certifications you go get in the government, contractors who are trying to bid after that work require those same certifications to go after those same seats. So they'll hire those guys out of the government, make them a government contractor and send them right back into that organization. And the government guys will go for that because traditionally it means a few extra bucks, a different work environment. you know, a commercial career path as opposed to, let's say, a career path in the government.
I mean, it is nuts, isn't it, that we consistently see some of these integrators and large consultancies go and hire people out of government departments, then sell them back by the hour at a greatly inflated rate to the same government department. I mean, surely it would make sense for the government to perhaps, you know, pay their people more. But I mean, there's problems that come with that too, right? Which is they wind up with, you know, a whole bunch of dunces who are welded to the organization who you can't fire because government.
Yeah, and that is very, very true. And the other one that I'll give you is to go the other way. So then the government, of course, as things have gotten more expensive, you know, and the government's trying to control costs, they're going out to the commercial sector and trying to levy requirements for certain certifications or years of experience, and then not paying what the market bears for those things. You know, Washington, D.C. is a classic example of this. You know, traditionally, most of the work that the federal government is looking for here, and I'll talk about Department of Defense or the intelligence community, is requiring a guy with many years of experience who also holds an active security clearance.
And well, is prepared to work for 50% of the market rate.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you're not realistic about finding that guy, because that same guy who, let's say programmers or developers in particular, some guys love mission. And I will argue with you, there are some things that you can do in the federal government that you'll never have access to do in the commercial space.
Mm.
Let's talk about some of the things, you know, without getting into the details, but, you know, computer network defense missions or what is now called offensive cyber operations or defensive cyber operations. Won't get into the details of either one of those, but the fact that they exist, you can't go do offensive cyber operations at Google. Or at least you can't go do them legally.
Well, you can in a bug bounty. I mean, that's one thing that's changing, right?
Sure.
Which is, you know, giving people the same thrills, right? But maybe not to the same degree. Like hacking an Instagram, you know, cross-site request forgery might not be the same as, you know, getting valuable intel from Rucker, you know?
Or being a mission planner who's tasked with going through center gravity analysis to identify vulnerabilities that exist within some of those systems. That's a very cool thing. And then develop. Be on the other side that helps develop capabilities that are aimed back at, you know, systems of our adversaries.
Chris, long story short, are things post OPM, are things actually getting better in DC, or is it too early to say?
I will say from a shining a spotlight on the problem and creating programs or initiatives to respond to the problem, yes, they are getting better.
But it's too early to tell if those programs are going to be successful?
Yes.
Mm. Well, Chris Cleary, thank you very much for joining us to discuss what is happening with the US federal government. It's very interesting because, you know, obviously the federal government in the United States has experienced some pretty high profile incidents over the past few years. It's interesting to see how it's responding. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
That was Tenable Network Security's very own Chris Cleary there with a look at what's happening in DC. Big thanks to Tenable Network Security for its continued support of the Risky Business Podcast. Do check them out at tenable.com. And that is it for this week's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.